the power to be able to determine what gets built where is the power to determine who gets built where. If you can say that in certain parts of the city, apartments are prohibited and only detached single family homes on half acre lots are allowed, well, guess what? Only very wealthy people get to live there.
Welcome to the City Age Podcast. I'm Alan Markovich, and I'm here with Anna Stafford. And that was Nolan Gray, author of Arbitrary Lines, How Zoning Broke the American City and How to Fix It.
Before we share my conversation with Nolan, you're going to hear from Joshua Humphreys, Senior Housing Policy Advisor to Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens. One of CityAge's co-founders, Miro Sernetig, sat down with Josh for this episode to talk about how Atlanta is approaching its housing needs. Atlanta is a really fast-growing and vibrant city, so it was great to have Josh on the show and to learn more about what goes into shaping a city's housing policy.
Yeah, Josh began his career as a grassroots community organizer in Los Angeles and New York before moving back to Atlanta to work for change from inside city government. As a community organizer, he worked on the Fight for $15 campaign and undocumented workers' rights efforts in LA. He helped build a breakthrough economic development program in New York that works to lift public housing communities from the cycle of poverty.
Here is Miro's conversation with Josh.
Hey, Josh. Thanks very much for joining us at CityAge. Tell me a little bit about what you do for Atlanta.
In my role here at the City of Atlanta, I serve as the Housing Policy Advisor to Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens. I work to help set and implement Mayor's strategic agenda around housing and addressing affordable housing in the city. And so the mayor has set an ambitious goal to build or preserve 20,000 affordable housing units by 2030. And so what we are working to do is to pull every policy, funding, and strategic lever we can to ensure that happens. And our goal really is, I mean, we talk about the 20,000 unit number, but we want to create whole, healthy neighborhoods and accessible housing for anyone who wants to live in the city, regardless of their income. And so we set that goal to push ourselves and to ensure that we are tracking against it. But we think really beyond just the housing unit. We think about quality housing, think about health and education, fresh food access, and the key thing that it takes to bring a neighborhood together and that everyone wants to have in their neighborhood. And for us, housing is a foundational building block of that work. And so our goal is to build a housing ecosystem here in Atlanta that is accessible to anyone who wants to live here.
What is the situation in Atlanta right now in terms of affordable housing?
The best way to explain where we're at in Atlanta is to look back about 50 years. So in 1970, Atlanta had a population that peaked. And like a lot of other places, Atlanta saw pretty significant population decline. We had a 25% population decline from 1970 through 1990 and had relatively stagnant, like minor growth from 1990 to 2010. And you have the recession that happens 2008, 2011. And we also had a period of time in the early 2000s where due to a number of reasons, we tore down all the public housing that we had. And so you lose a lot of housing stock, the recession pulls back a lot of, it destabilizes the market in a lot of ways. A lot of homeowners lose their homes as a result of that. And then you get into 2010, and from 2010 to 2020, the city regained all the population that it lost over the previous 50 years and is now at an all-time population high. So we're increasing our population really rapidly in a situation where we didn't have enough housing stock ready to go to meet that demand. And so there's a supply and demand imbalance that's created a lot of challenges in the market and pushing, particularly in the moderate and lower income portions of the market. We just don't have enough housing stock to meet the demands of our residents. And so that's what's facing us kind of at a macroeconomic level in the city. And so we are earnestly looking to build as much housing as we possibly can in the city and housing that meets both from a housing typology and a price point standpoint the diverse needs of our residents.
So how are you doing that? Like, how do you catalyze affordable housing in a city like Atlanta?
One initiative that I'm really keen on is the work we're doing on publicly owned land. So the city of Atlanta has really across, and when I say city of Atlanta here, I'm thinking broadly all the different public agencies that are owned or controlled by the city. So the Housing Authority or partners like the Transit Authority, we collectively own a lot of vacant land. Vacant sites that could be redeveloped are really important. And so what we've done since Mayor Dickens took office at the beginning of last year is, lack of a better word, treasure hunting of like, what sites do we have that we are not fully leveraging? And so sometimes that's a vacant parking lot next to a transit station. We have a heavy rail transit station in south of downtown, right in the urban core of the city, that it's a 1 acre lot that we've been using for surface parking for city employees for a number of decades. And we found it and realized that it had really good transit oriented housing development opportunity to build affordable housing, to build housing on transit, to build in our downtown. We started working on the process and actually have a current request for proposals out right now to find a development partner to build on that vacant parking lot and add new mixed income housing on there.
How many homes would you get on that specific lot?
So a site like that will probably be somewhere between 200 and 300 housing units. And so a portion of those will be affordable, a portion of them market rate. You know, I think for our goal is to create mixed income housing wherever we can, because we know we have a supply shortage. Creating market rate housing also helps our housing affordability challenges and will help cross subsidize the deal so that we can, you know, ensure that the affordable housing is viable.
So developers are an important part of this equation, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that our goal when it comes to this is to, you know, we've been working to build up professional expertise and subject matter expertise around housing development and financing at the city. I think oftentimes public entities may own a lot of land that sits vacant, underutilized. And one of the big challenges is just a lack of understanding of what resources are available and how they can be leveraged. So as we've added that capacity, it allows us to have better partnerships with developers, right, to ensure that the public benefit return is maximized, right? If our goals are affordability and long-term viability of the site, I'll give an example of one. The Midtown, we're working on a project in a fire station in Midtown Atlanta, and it's a 1970s fire station that needs to be renovated. We also, you know, it's really good housing market that can do, you know, probably 300 plus housing units. And so what we're working on is a partnership to rebuild the fire station on the ground floor and build housing above it. So in addition to getting affordable housing goals met, we're able to get a new fire station out of it as well, but do so in a way that allows the project to pencil, that private development can help see that through and the project is financially stable.
You want to build 20,000 affordable homes. How much land do you really need to do that?
It varies, right? I mean, some, you know, an acre lot in the urban core that you're building, let's say 300 units on, that's 300 units on a single acre of land. That's dense, very urban infill, right? A more suburban areas of the city may do 30 or 40 units in a given acre. So a lot of that varies from side to side and really trying to think about where growth makes the most sense, how to position land in a way that works for the given neighborhood that it's located in. We have all in about 2,000 unit or 2,000 acres of publicly owned land that we think has development viability. And so that's what we're focused on, is how we can activate that and move that forward. We're in the process now of going through due diligence, figuring out which sites are easy win sites, which sites may have, you know, brownfield issues or other impediments that may make it difficult to develop. We've identified a couple of batches to start with that make sense. They're easy wins. They're ready to move forward, and some that are catalytic. And so we're confident we can build the vast majority of the 20,000 affordable housing units that we're trying to build on publicly owned land. But as far as, you know, how many exact acres, that's going to vary, because once you get into the details of a given site, the total number of units and stuff, you know, varies quite a bit.
But essentially you have enough land to meet your targets.
Yeah, I think so. We do have enough land to build 20,000 affordable housing units. But our goal, just to be clear, our goal for hitting our 20,000 housing unit goal is also we're also looking at preservation as well. So yeah, we are actively looking to build as many as we can on publicly owned land. We want to stimulate private market affordable housing where we can. But on the preservation side, there are a lot of existing older multifamily stock that are maybe a little run down or in downright poor condition. And in those situations, we want to save as many as we can, because preserving is a lot cheaper than building new construction. And so we are balancing out our new construction work on public land with a preservation approach to ensure that we can raise any substandard housing and preserve it as affordable in the long run for existing housing stock that we do have.
When you're dealing with that land, does the developer, do they buy that land off you, or does the city hold on to it and lease it out? Like, how's that model work?
Our model and our approach to all of this has been around long-term relationship with the land, right? So oftentimes that takes its form in a ground lease. There are times when we've looked at different types of joint venture type structures with the development partner as well, but ground lease is the most common. Our goal really is to be a part of the deal in the long run, right? If we sell a property now before it gets developed, not only is it the cheapest value the land's ever going to be at, once it gets developed, it's going to be worth a lot more. But also it gets us out of the deal and our ability to ensure long-term affordability and long-term benefit, public benefit dwindles. And so our approach to this is to really have a long horizon view on this, that we want to build 20,000 affordable housing units right now. But we also want to think about the next 15, 20, 30, 50 years from now and ensuring that there is a public footprint that is keeping housing affordable, that's ensuring high quality housing, and in some cases, generating financial return on the long run on these deals. If the property value increases over time, that the public actually gets a financial return that can be used to either redevelop other sites or pursue other public needs. And so our take on this has been really to think about a long-term position in these properties.
So what happens if you don't have affordable housing?
Well, I think that folks have to find somewhere to live, right? I mean, that's the basic question that they have to solve for. And if we don't have housing that's accessible to them, then residents can either pay more and more of their income for housing. We think of how cost burden is a metric that we look closely at. And a cost burden is defined as if you're spending more than 30% of your family's income on housing, you're considered to be cost burden. And so more and more families, actually one in two renters in the city of Atlanta are considered cost burden. So 48%, I believe it is the most recent number, 48% of Atlanta residents that rent are paying more than 30% of their income on housing at this point. And so that creates a lot of pinch for those residents. And oftentimes just because they can't find housing that is cheap enough for them. The other option is oftentimes moving further away from the city center, that there's more affordable housing. Oftentimes if you get further outside of the city, I think that creates compounding problems. Oftentimes if you're a transit dependent person, don't have access to a car, moving to the suburbs can mean you no longer have easy access to your job or fresh food or otherwise. And then the other, you know, if you do choose to have a car, that's another cost that has to be added in, right? And the average cost of car ownership per year in the U.S. is somewhere between $8,000 and $10,000, in a recent report on that. And so forcing, you know, not having enough housing in town for residents that is close to jobs and other key resources could mean that residents have to move further away from that and have to spend more money on things like a car ownership in order to get around. And so for us, like, I mean, it's really important that we create enough housing in the urban core of the city so that we can ensure residents have, you know, high quality of life.
A downtown neighborhood, if it doesn't have affordable housing, like, what does life look like? Are we an endless spiral of gentrification, or is it just does it just get hollowed out? Or what's your experience on that?
Well, you know, I'll use Atlanta's downtown kind of as a specific example here. Downtown Atlanta right now actually has pretty limited residential population. There's a growing student population in downtown Atlanta, but otherwise it's primarily hotels and offices. And so for the way we look at downtown Atlanta, and it's a key focus area of ours, we're working on, you know, office to residential conversions. And, you know, one of the projects I mentioned at the beginning of the call, you know, taking surface parking lots downtown and building as much housing as we can. We view downtown as an area of the city that can take on a lot of housing. I think growing where growth makes the most sense is a key part of a growing city. And we've got a heavy rail system. You've got access to key amenities. And so for us, we're doing everything we can to bring as much housing as possible to downtown Atlanta right now. Because of the nature of downtown, this is not an area where challenges of gentrification are as strong. It's really an area where we can add a lot of housing and actually take pressure off of neighborhoods that are facing more significant gentrification pressures, right? Downtown can take on that with less infrastructure demand and because of the existing resources it has versus a single family neighborhood a little bit further outside the city that is seeing rising costs because of growing population in that area. So for us, our focus and the way we think about downtown Atlanta is we think it really is a key part of all of this, of bringing more housing downtown can relieve pressure in other parts of the city.
So Josh, do you think this is a crisis right now in the United States?
I do think it's at a crisis level. I think that larger, the San Francisco, New Yorks of the world are a few years ahead of where Atlanta is as far as the cost of living and the inability to provide affordable housing. But I think cities like Atlanta that if we don't take seriously the challenge ahead of us, then we'll be there very soon. And that's why proud to work for a mayor and be able to get to work on these projects to make it housing work better in Atlanta. Because I do think that this is a solvable problem. I think that it requires a lot of political will and commitment, a financial commitment and collaboration, both with neighborhoods and residents and private partners and public agencies. But I do think that addressing affordable housing, that it's not too late for Atlanta, but it is serious and requires that we act immediately and we act with a decent amount of force to accomplish this.
How hopeful are you about what's happening in Atlanta?
I'm very hopeful. We have a mayor that is very serious about addressing affordable housing, and he has galvanized a group of folks, at public agencies, private partners, and the like, that have jumped in and said, hey, we want to be a part of solving this problem. I'll give you one example to kind of close us out. It's about a year ago, we launched a faith-based housing initiative, and the mayor stood in a church downtown and said, hey, we're going to build on our public land, our underutilized sites. We're going to build as much housing as we can. And I know that faith institutions often have a lot of underutilized land as well. And I'm asking you to take your parking lots and your grassy fields next to your synagogue or your church and build housing with me to help address this problem and provide housing for people who need it. And we've had an outstanding response. We've had over 300 faith institutions engage with us. We have 15 projects that have already selected development partners that are looking to build, and another 15 or 20 that are in the process of working with their congregation to figure out exactly how they're going to build housing on their sites. Those are non-traditional types of partnerships, right? You don't often see the mayor and the pastor of a church coming together to build affordable housing on a church parking lot. But that's what's happening in Atlanta. And I think that I think that makes me very hopeful, right? That together we can address this problem. A mayor's fond of calling Atlanta a group project. And I think that addressing affordable housing will require a group effort for that. And it's fun to watch those unlikely partnerships come together to address this problem.
The challenges facing local leaders are bigger than ever. So are the opportunities for real change.
I'm Kate Ryba from Urban 3.
And I'm Ben McAdams, a former state senator and member of Congress. We're hosting a new podcast called The Possible City.
We'll talk to mayors and other local leaders about how they find the financial and political capital to make things happen in their cities.
We're talking to some truly great leaders about what they're doing and what's possible in America's cities.
Available now at possible.city or wherever podcasts are found.
What a great conversation. I'm so impressed by what Atlanta is doing on the housing front. Atlanta actually is such an exciting city that CityAge is visiting it this fall for one of our conferences. So I'm really glad we could hear from Josh today.
Next up is my conversation with Nolan Gray.
Nolan wrote the book Arbitrary Lines, How Zoning Broke the American City and How to Fix It. He's the research director for California YIMBY and an expert in urban land use regulation. Nolan previously worked as a planner in New York City, where he worked on the front lines of zoning. He's a widely published author with work appearing in outlets such as The Atlantic, Bloomberg City Lab, and The Guardian. Nolan lives in LA and is originally from Lexington, Kentucky. You might be able to hear that in his accent.
Zoning might sound boring, but it's actually shaping and contributing to our city's most pressing problems. Zoning has been getting a lot more mainstream attention lately as people begin to realize what Nolan writes in his book, that zoning codes are worsening our housing crisis, climate crisis, racial and economic segregation, and restricting economic growth and innovation in our most productive cities.
Anna and Nolan discuss that and more in the upcoming discussion.
For people who maybe don't know or don't have a very strong grasp on it, what is zoning and why did cities start doing it?
Right. Yeah. So most people live happy, well-adjusted lives where they know nothing about zoning. And if you want to remain that way, with apologies to the host, I encourage you to hop off. But for the rest of us, I actually think zoning is a really fascinating thing to think about, because when you understand zoning, you can really understand why your city looks the way it does. And so zoning is essentially doing two things. It's breaking the city out into districts. And for every single one of those districts, it's saying for every single parcel in the city, these are the allowed land uses that you can build on that parcel. And this is the density and the form that that use can take. So for example, on the use front, many cities are strictly segregated as a matter of policy on the basis of residential, commercial, industrial. There are going to be discrete areas of the city where you live, where you work, where you play. And of course, within each of those use categories, there's almost a dizzying array of subcategories. So most US cities will say, within residential districts, only detached single family homes are allowed in this area. And maybe we'll allow townhouses or apartments in that area. And same with commercial, right? In commercial, you might have commercial zone that says only office parks here, or only strip mall style development. The second big piece of that is all of these rules that broadly regulate the density or the bulk, there are a whole bunch of different ways that folks refer to it, of the buildings that do get built. So of course, most people know about things like height limits and maybe even stuff like setbacks or how far back a building has to be set from the property line. But you have a whole thicket of rules like lot coverage, how much of the lot can a property actually take up? In many cases, that can be as low as 30%. You know, floor area ratios, how much floor area are you allowed to build based on how large the lot is? Minimum lot sizes, how large of a lot do you need to be able to build a property? How many units can you have per acre? So there's this thicket of rules that essentially add up to very heavily regiment what buildings actually end up looking like, and then how much density you have in any given one place. And of course, as I argue in the book, that's had a whole bunch of knockoff negative effects for cities.
Can you tell us a bit more about the origins of zoning and why cities started doing it in the first place?
Yeah. So for you know, most of human history, humans have been doing stuff like land use planning, right? You sit down and you plan out a street grid. Ideally, you plan out water and sewer. Maybe you plan out some public spaces. You plan where major public facilities are going to go. Humans have been doing that for a very long time. Zoning, or this systematic segregation of use and restrictions on density, it's a very young institution. So in the U.S. context, this zoning starts to come online in the 19-teens, first adopted in 1916 in a few cities. But in the book, I really focus on New York City and Berkeley. And, you know, I partly tell that story because I want to challenge, I think, some of the assumptions that people have about zoning. So, you know, of course, it's in the name of the book, Arbitrary. I think a lot of people come to zoning and they assume, well, this probably has some health and safety basis, or this is probably just good government stuff, or this is just necessary to, like, rationalize a city. Yeah. But in many cases, if you actually peel it back and, you know, ask why were cities adopting these codes, the motivations were not always motivations that we would sort of acknowledge today as valid purposes of local regulation. So in the New York City context, one of the main advocates for zoning was the Fifth Avenue Association, posh retailers along Fifth Avenue that were concerned about industrial development creeping up near them. And you read that with modern eyes and you think, oh, okay, yeah, I mean, they're concerned about noise, or they're concerned about smoke, or they're concerned about, you know, smells. But you actually read text from the time, and what they're worried about is, well, the factories bring in poor factory girls who then come onto Fifth Avenue and scare away our clientele. So you need to move those to another part of a city. There's a social project underwriting a lot of these rules. Similar dynamic in Berkeley, which also adopted zoning in 1916. And Berkeley is interesting. It looks a lot more like a modern zoning code today. And it pioneered a policy called single family zoning that said that in the vast majority of the city, the only type of housing that can legally be built is a detached single family home. And same thing, there's a social project that I think would be somewhat offensive to a modern reader of this notion of, well, if you can't afford a detached single family home, we don't want you in this community. And even similar thing with industrial zoning, even in Berkeley, you read the Berkeley you read the promotional material for the Berkeley zoning code. And it says, well, we need to keep industrial uses out of residential neighborhoods. And again, you read that with modern eyes and you're like, well, yeah, of course, that makes total sense. But then what industrial uses are they concerned about? Well, they're explicitly trying to get Chinese laundries out of residential neighborhoods. And so, you know, these codes are adopted in many cases in 1916, 19 teens. Federal government comes in the 1920s and then does a major push, basically mails out legislation to every single state saying you should adopt these things to make sure that local governments can adopt zoning. And then, of course, over the 20th century, many jurisdictions adopt it. In many cases, adopting zoning was a condition for receiving federal funding or for having federal housing policies take effect. And of course, another really key part of the story, maybe we can talk about, in the over the course of the 1960s, 70s, 80s, a lot of these rules became dramatically stricter. And that's sort of the situation we find ourselves in today, where it's very, very, very hard to build much of anything without requiring some sort of discretionary relief. So all development gets politicized.
So would you say that the motivation for zoning is sort of this social project that you're talking about, which is really about exclusion, layered in with genuine concern about health and safety and land use? Or would you say it is simply a tool for exclusion that's masked as concern for health and safety?
I would say it's overwhelmingly the latter. A tool of exclusion that flies under the radar of health and safety.
Yeah.
You know, before zoning, many cities had even some degree of land use regulation that imposed segregation, for example, with really offensive uses, right? So most cities, even before zoning, would say, okay, look, if you're going to operate a slaughterhouse or if you're going to operate, you know, a tannery or a forge or something that's really going to be a genuine public nuisance, it can only be in certain areas, or it has to be outside the corporate limits of the city. You had a lot of that before the rise of modern zoning, or rules saying, you know, certain uses had to be so many feet from maybe more sensitive uses, right? Mm-hmm. What zoning adds on to that is this framework where we can actually just segregate cities on the basis of race and then by connection class, and then really regiment this, a very particular type of urban form that isn't necessarily based on health and safety, but is based on notions of what the correct city looks like. And of course, that reflects the attitudes and prejudices of a very particular type of elite from a very particular time. And this is the situation we find ourselves in today, is that we're in a straitjacket that was designed by these previous generations, and finding ourselves in a situation where it's, wow, we can't build the infill housing we need. We can't build the walkable communities that we want. We can't build the more mixed use and integrated neighborhoods that we once had.
Can you tell us a little bit more about why the zoning rules have become stricter in more recent decades?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a few theories about this. You know, a popular one is the idea that homeowners realized that they actually had a financial stake in housing affordability. So the U.S. is somewhat unique in that we really heavily subsidize and incentivize folks to think of their homes as an investment. Like, your home is this thing that's going to go up in value and it's going to make you fabulously wealthy, and then you're going to be able to retire on it. The trouble is that is in tension with the objective of keeping housing affordable. Like, housing is a necessity. It's a thing that people need. You know, imagine if, like, we had a situation where a huge share of the American population's retirement plan was tied up in bread prices going up, right? Like, that would also, we would probably have the same level of dysfunction in food markets. Mm-hmm. But so, that's one theory, is this notion that homeowners sort of wised up that, hey, if we downzone and make it really incumbent, I don't want to just say homeowners, but all incumbent property owners, people who already own property, realize, oh, cool, if we make it harder to build here, the value of my asset is going to go up. I think that's definitely part of it. You know, I also think, too, what's part of what's going on is that folks just have a reflexive concern about change, right? You know, I think it's a basic human instinct to a certain extent that folks are a little skeptical about things changing around them. And I'm sympathetic to that. But of course, you know, if you are in a city that's got a healthy growing economy, or if you're in a city that is maybe in a very desirable region that a lot of people want to move to, you can't just pull up the ladder. You can't just say, hey, we're never going to change because it's uncomfortable. You know, I think that a little bit of maturity is required to say, hey, keeping our city affordable and healthy and dynamic actually depends on a little bit of growth. And you see a little bit of cultural variation there. You know, I think in certain parts of the US, there's still this acceptance of, yeah, we're going to grow and change over time. And you know, if you don't want anything to change around you, you're always welcome to move out to the middle of nowhere. The U.S. is a fairly empty country. But you have many, many cities where the explicit goal of zoning and other policies like historic preservation The explicit goal is to essentially lock neighborhoods in amber and make it to where they never change. And of course, after 50 years of trying to do that, we're dealing with the dysfunction of that. We don't have enough housing. We don't have enough growth in places that are well-suited to growth. Folks are being priced out of high opportunity cities and neighborhoods. And of course, is at the root of so many other issues.
You mentioned earlier on the role that the federal government played in rolling out zoning. Today in America, who really holds the pen in terms of the zoning codes for a city? Who's in charge of them and who has the power to change them?
Yeah, I mean, so this is one of the myths that I really wanted to tackle in the book. I think there's this notion that zoning was this bottom-up, you know, thing that folks were, you know, bum-rushing their city councils demanding that that zoning be adopted. And it's a much more complex story than that, right? I mean, as I suggested earlier, in the 1920s, the U.S. Department of Commerce drafts model zoning legislation and mails it out to every single state in the country and says, hey, you should adopt this. And then, of course, they follow. Mm-hmm. In many cases, as I was mentioning earlier, there were heavy federal subsidies or it was a condition to heavy federal subsidies to undertake the adoption of zoning codes, or adopting a zoning code was a condition for federal housing finance benefits, or it was a condition, even to this day, it was a condition for certain environmental conservation grants, or it was a condition for federal emergency response. So there are all these reasons that cities and towns actually adopted zoning that might not necessarily be for any actual popular demand. And I would add too, you know, another element of the spread of zoning is that very rarely were these codes actually even voted on. Right. So, you know, I don't want to jump the gun here, but, you know, as I say in the book, the only major city that actually held a referendum on zoning was Houston, and it voted it down. In almost every other jurisdiction, these codes were adopted with really not a lot of public input, at least initially. But in terms of who holds the pen today, for the most part, right, we've created a system where local governments have almost completely unconstrained control over how they administer these powers. Zoning is seen as the exclusive purview of local governments. This, of course, creates problems, right? Because what you have in the U.S. is it's very easy for very, very small, you know, you have a lot of incorporated little municipalities that effectively are just neighborhoods, and they're able to completely control land use within their boundaries. The trouble with that is that housing markets and labor markets don't stop and start at municipal boundaries. In many cases, they're metro-wide. And so housing affordability and sustainability and equity and economic opportunity, these are matters of statewide concern. And these zoning powers that are being abused by local governments are actually powers that are delegated to local governments by the state. And so what I think you're seeing right now is more and more states saying, well, of course, we want local governments to reform on their own volition. And that's great. And there's a lot of great examples of that. But we can also put up guardrails and say, hey, we're going to set general standards for how these powers are administered to make sure that they're not used in a way that actually undermines the welfare of the state as a whole.
You've touched on a few of these, but some of the low-hanging fruit for potential reforms, can you walk through those quickly for us?
At the end of the day, the way we've structured the system, local governments have extremely wide latitude over how to administer these powers. And local governments can liberalize their zoning codes tomorrow, removing a lot of these rules at very little cost to, or no cost to the taxpayer, to immediately stimulate new housing production. So, mm-hmm. for example, policies like phasing out single-family zoning. I think I don't really love the rhetoric there, because actually what you're doing is you're ending an apartment prohibition. You say we're going to end single family zoning and people think, oh, you're going to make it illegal to build a single family home. No, all you're doing is you're saying we're ending the mandate that the only thing you can build is a single family home. So you're seeing more jurisdictions do that and essentially say we're going to allow duplexes or small multifamily buildings in all residential areas. There's no health and safety basis for banning those. You know, I think a milder version of that that we've seen that's just spread like wildfire is legalizing accessory dwelling units. So saying, hey, we're going to allow homeowners, if they would like, to maybe turn that spare basement or that spare attic or that spare shed or garage into an additional rental unit and to get more housing, especially in high opportunity areas. You know, abolishing parking requirements, right? Like, we just know that these increase costs and they force city, they increase traffic congestion. They force cities to sprawl out more. And I'm seeing all across the country, cities are just reevaluating those rules. Lowering minimum lot sizes or minimum unit sizes. These are literally just regulations that say housing has to be so expensive. Minimum unit sizes are, from a health and safety perspective, are already regulated by the building code. But what you'll get is jurisdictions will say, well, we're not going to allow you to build a home unless it's 2,000 square feet. There's no health and safety basis for that. That's purely to say a certain type of person is not going to be allowed to live here. I'd say the final sort of really important thing in the near term at the local level is legalizing inherently affordable forms of housing. So things like single room occupancies, ending discriminatory treatment of manufactured housing, for example. Those are the homes that urban, suburban, rural context, those are the homes that are the sort of bottom of the housing market. Frankly, they're our safety net. They're the places where, if nothing else, you can afford one of those units. But in many contexts, those are actually illegal.
Right.
At the state level, I think we're seeing a lot of different stuff, putting up guardrails around all of those different rules. So here in California, since 2016, the state has said accessory dwelling units are legal statewide. Here are the standards that local governments have to follow. And we've seen a big ADU building boom as a result of that. Something like 1 in 4 units built in Los Angeles last year was an ADU. You know, I was just in Montana, where they're pushing for legislation that will set a statewide minimum lot size of 2,500 square feet anywhere that's incorporated and has water and sewer. That is to say, context where there's really no health and safety basis for having large, expensive lot sizes that raise housing costs and force cities to sprawl. I was just reading about the exciting stuff in Arizona, where they're going to say, hey, we're removing parking requirements on residential properties. So we're seeing a lot of exciting movement at both the local and state level, and increasingly federal conversations are coming up. You know, I think the role of the federal government in land use planning is relatively limited, but they can use federal dollars to undo, I think, some of the damage that previous federal policies did and say, hey, if we're going to give you money for transit, we want to see a plan that you're going to actually allow new housing to be built near that transit. Or if we're going to give you community development block grants, we want to see some plan for removing these rules that have their roots in exclusion. I think those are all positive sort of small nudges to say, you know, we're not going to force anyone to do anything, but we're not going to reward you if you're not leading on reform in this space where we all know reform is needed.
Just walk us through why people should care about zoning and the impact that it's having on urban life in America.
Yeah, well, I mean, so very quickly in the book, I cover 4 of what I take to be the more salient critiques of zoning. There were many more that I didn't include, but there are 4. I think the first is the relationship between zoning and the current housing affordability crisis. Zoning makes it illegal to build many types of housing. The housing that zoning does allow to be built, it often requires that it be much more expensive. Even when housing can be built, zoning often requires a very discretionary and highly risky politicized permitting process. So, you know, that's, I think, what draws a lot of people to this issue area. And the evidence of this is just really overwhelming, that metropolitan areas that have more restrictive zoning have higher housing prices. You have policies like single family zoning that just make it illegal to build anything other than a detached single family home. You have rules like minimum lot sizes that say if you can't afford at least 10,000 square feet of land, you're not allowed to build a detached single family home here, even if maybe you would have wanted to build a home on a 2,500 square foot lot. Similar dynamic with parking requirements. And then, of course, even if you can clear all that, then you have to go have multiple public hearings, environmental reviews, potentially deal with litigation. These are the issues that we're really chewing on at California YEMBY, and where I think we're making actually a lot of really exciting progress. I would say another sort of knock-on effect here is that because these zoning restrictions are most tight in some of our highest opportunity areas, right? Places like the Bay Area or metropolitan New York City, it's actually hard for Americans to move there. And what we're seeing is a historical reversal of trends. Historically, Americans moved from less prosperous, less productive places to prosperous, high productivity places, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so there are innumerable examples of this from American history, the great migration of African Americans out of the South, the mass movement of, you know, in my family history, I'm from Kentucky originally, the movement of folks out of Appalachia and into the industrial Midwest. Originally, Americans could move to prosperity. And this is very much like baked into our DNA. You can move to a place and improve your quality of life and work hard and do better. Now, of course, Americans have to move out of our most prosperous and productive places simply because the housing prices are too high. They have to move to less productive places just to afford a decent home. Of course, that makes us all poor, and there's really great data on the sort of broader economic cost of that. The third thing, and this was top of mind, I was writing the book in 2020, living in downtown DC. Summer of 2020, of course, a lot of folks remember you had the Black Lives Matter protest well underway. And, you know, as I'm writing this book, you're reading more about the history of zoning and the relationship between zoning and segregation. You know, just to riff on the early origins of a lot of these codes, you go back and look at this discussion that was underway of why we need to adopt zoning. And in many cases, it's fairly explicit. We want to adopt zoning because we want to institutionalize segregation. Mm-hmm. Zoning emerges in a very unique context. So in 1917, the Supreme Court in the decision Buchanan v. Worley said, we're not going to allow explicitly racial segregation. So what you had was, in this case, Louisville, but many cities across the South were saying, we're going to define areas where whites and blacks are allowed to live, and we're going to do it in a very explicit way. I mean, this was South Africa style segregation. The Supreme Court says, can't do that. It's not a valid exercise of local regulation. But what you get in the aftermath of that is every little city, town, and suburb across the country says, well, we still want to have segregation, but we can't explicitly mention race. And this is where I think a lot of modern zoning starts to come into the picture, is that with zoning, it's very core to what zoning is doing is institutionalizing class segregation, saying, you know, the power to be able to determine what gets built where is the power to determine who gets built where. If you can say that in certain parts of the city, apartments are prohibited and only detached single family homes on half acre lots are allowed, well, guess what? Only very wealthy people get to live there. And in the US context, of course, that has racial implications. And we see this even to this day, this relationship between zoning and racial segregation. And there's great data, you know, suggesting that cities that were early adopters of a lot of these codes actually ended up quite a bit more segregated than cities that didn't adopt them or were late adopters. So I think as we're reckoning with racial inequality and inherited patterns of segregation, zoning is very top of mind. The last big critique that I level is the relationship between zoning and sustainability. As I was mentioning earlier, zoning presupposes that you're going to live in one part of town, you're going to work in another part of town, you're going to shop in another part of town. And then, of course, you're going to go between all of those places via car. And there are a whole bunch of other sort of smaller rules that essentially write that into law. So, of course, I talk a lot about minimum parking requirements, which say regardless of what a developer wants to build and regardless of what maybe a resident or a tenant actually wants, so much parking has to be built. And we essentially force the construction of huge parking lots. This is at the top of the conversation. I said, if you understand zoning, you can understand your city. Go out to any given nearby suburban strip mall and take a look at what you see. You'll see this, you know, squat one-story commercial strip. It probably is going to be 25 to 50% empty. And you're going to see this vast parking lot that has never been full, not even full on Black Friday on the year the strip mall opened. And you wonder, why did that happen? Like, why did all this parking get built? Why did this like manifestly, you know, unsustainable development get built? And in many cases, it's because you had really high parking requirements, or you had extremely low lot coverage requirements, or you had rules that said, no, sorry, you're not allowed to build apartments over top of commercial uses. Of course, this just generates cities that are totally dependent on cars, where folks who might want to live a lifestyle where they walk or take a bike or ride a bus actually can't. So those are the four big critiques. You know, there are other critiques that I think are valid. The relationship between zoning and corruption comes up a lot. The relationship between zoning and architectural design and experimentation comes a lot. But these are the things that I think are most compelling to people.
I think that's an awesome place to end the conversation. Thanks for coming on the show, Nolan. We really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. I'm thrilled we could have Nolan on the show. To break down some of the ways zoning is impacting North American cities, it's really fascinating stuff, and it's very timely too.
Yeah, I read Arbitrary Lines last year, and even as someone who talks to city leaders and about city issues, I didn't fully appreciate the impact that zoning was having on our cities or the origins of the practice, which are pretty astounding to read about. So if you're interested, I definitely recommend picking up a copy of Nolan's book and giving it a read. We'll link to it in the show notes.
And that's it for today, Anna. This was the City Age Podcast. Next episode, we've got a great conversation with Susanna Pierce, who's the President and Country Chair and the VP of Emerging Energy Solutions for Shell Canada. Please join us, because after all, you can't build the future alone.